Hi, this is Brian Castillo from the Fighting Irish. You're listening to the D-Fly and Dixie podcast on Inside the Cross.
Coming to you from the IL Podcast Studio in the Baltimore, Maryland, worldwide headquarters of Inside Lacrosse, it's the D-Fly and Dixie Podcast, featuring Inside Lacrosse, ESPN, Big Ten Network analyst, and my old friend, Mark Dixon. I am your host, Dan Flynn. Dix, let's get it! Welcome to the quarterfinal round, Dixie. Big week, big week.
Money round. You win this, and you're a Final Four team in college lacrosse. And memories for a lifetime. I went to two national championship weekends as a member of the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays. Unfortunately, there were short stays in 92 and 93. We lost in that semifinal round, but still, you feel like a rock star going to these games. You get a police escort for your team bus from the hotel to the stadium, and nice dinners, and fans are in your hotel, and this is the time of year when most schools, if not all schools, are done. You're done exams, you're done all of your academic work, you're done all the activities that you might have to be involved with, and you're solely a lacrosse player, and you're around your teammates all the time, and it's just a really cool time, and this is the money round. This is where you're either advancing to play for a national championship, or you just missed that opportunity to go to championship weekend. So it'll be great. Can't wait to dive into it with you.
Yeah, and just to add to that thought, you also get to play in front of the biggest crowd that a lacrosse player will ever play in front of, which is a really cool thing. Be part of that experience.
Right on.
All right, Dixie. How was your Mother's Day weekend? You were up at Penn State doing the ESPN game there?
Yeah, it was busy. You know, Saturday was great because I got to watch my younger son play in his club game, and I've missed pretty much all of his club games this year due to work. So it was nice to be able to watch him play and watch his team play. And then I hopped in the car, drove up to Penn State, got settled in, and then Sunday did the game. Missed a lot of games with my travel, driving to Penn State on Saturday and then home on Sunday, but was able to get home in time to catch my wife and my boys and spend a little bit of Mother's Day with them. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to catch up with my own mom, but I did speak with her, and she had a nice Mother's Day, so it was good, and it was crummy weather, huh?
Yes,
I mean, raining and really, really
awful
chilly
rain.
And raw and just kind of nasty, so I was happy that my wife's afternoon and evening consisted of watching lacrosse and just hanging out and having a good time. We're having our kitchen remodeled, by the way. They started that last week, so our house is an absolute disaster. So I was able to pick up food on the way back, bring it home, was the hero with dinner, and it was nice. How about yours? How about your Mother's Day?
Oh, it was wonderful. My wife, God bless her, she doesn't ask for a spa treatment or some pampering around Mother's Day. What she wants to do is family stuff. So for the second year in a row, we went to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and took our kids to Dutch Wonderland, like our 5-year-old and our 3-year-old, and it had a blast.
I remember you doing that last year. That was a frequent stop at the Dixon Boys when they were younger.
Yeah, I had a really good time. Saw some magic show on Friday night. That was really cool. The whole family at different times got to get up on stage. It was really fun. Played our first family mini golf excursion on Saturday night after a full day at Dutch Wonderland. It was a lot of fun. And then on the way home, a special Mother's Day brunch stop at a really nice place. And it was a nice, nice weekend. But yeah, you're right. The weather was
good
really bad.
You.
Luckily on Saturday,
the weather stunk.
Our day at Dutch Wonderland, the weather was really nice. So we had a good day there.
Oh, good.
My little 3-year-old guy, he's not ready for things that, like mini golf, that require absolute focus. He picked up everybody's ball on just about every hole. He was mostly interested in slamming his putter into the rocks and all the other stuff that was around the putt-putt course. But my daughter, she was super into it, and I might have to get her out to a driving range or something. She was really...
She was locked in.
She was.
I was going to say how many meltdowns happened during mini golf, but it sounds like it was more distractions than being upset about anything.
Yeah, totally. That. There was a meltdown on Monday night, though. My three-year-old, who about 7 months ago put a edamame bean that he found on the ground up his nose, and I had to take him to the pediatric ER for that to get it pulled out.
Right.
He did it again, this time with a peanut, which I took him to the first place, and they said, we don't have the equipment here to get that out of there. So I had to take him to Howard County General Hospital, have him like processed and admitted so that they could get the peanut out.
Oh my goodness.
Good wow. times. Good times. Thanks, Bennett. That was cool. All right. Let's
I don't miss up. Those days. I miss when my kids were younger, but I don't miss those days.
It's a good father, son bonding experience, I guess.
Right.
Going to the different ERs on a Monday night. That was a lot of fun.
Great.
Hey, let's get to these games. All right. On to the quarterfinals. 8 teams advanced out of last week's first round. Some really good games, some fun games to watch. And in our first game, Saturday, May 18th, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, the Maryland Terrapins, victors over the Towson Tigers in a thrilling, thrilling game. We'll play number 3 seed Virginia at noon.
Old ACC rivals. And this game is going to be a lot of fun. Interestingly enough, these guys have not played one another. Maryland and Virginia have not played one another since the Terps exited for the Big Ten. Their last meeting was 2014. Maryland won that game 9-6. And the last time these guys met in the NCAA tournament was 2011 in a final won by Steel Stanwyck and the Virginia Cavaliers 9-7 in M&T Bank Stadium where the playing surface was about 120 degrees.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I think
it's hot.
Yeah. It was torturous, but I think the weather will be much nicer this weekend in Long Island, and you've got two teams going after each other that I think the defenses need to be exceptional in this game. Maryland, I thought, was pretty good against Towson, much improved from their 2 losses to Johns Hopkins. I thought Danny Dolan, their goaltender, was really good. I had to watch that back on replay. And, you know, Virginia, I think, Dan, I'm going to say it right now. I think, you know, everybody's talking about Penn State as the odds-on favorite to win the national championship, and I don't disagree with that. I think Virginia is a team that could win the national championship with the effort that they put forth in the ACC tournament, with the effort that they put forth against a very good Robert Morris team that is, wow, really turned it around and making their second straight NCAA tournament appearance. So I think you're going to see Maryland play a little bit more methodical within the framework of the shot clock. I think Virginia is going to be frantic and more frenetic and up and down, and the styles work for each of the ball clubs. And this is going to be a fun game to watch up in Long Island.
Who do you think would be the X factors in this game for each team?
I really like Roman Puglisi. I'm not sure why he doesn't play more for Maryland. He had a big play late in the game against Towson where he intercepted a pass and took it from defense to offense. I believe that might have even been an overtime, if I'm not mistaken, to get Terps possession. And then Ryan Conrad for Virginia, just a ground ball machine. I think he had 3 or 4 goals against Robert Morris, so he can score in transition. He's the real key cog for the transition game for Virginia. Yeah, I think Alex Rode is going to be big. I don't think he's an X factor, but I think he's been playing well lately. So Dolan and Rode, both goaltenders, I think are going to be huge in this game. I think the big question for me, Dan, is can Maryland match the energy and the overall athleticism of Virginia? And I think this Maryland team has shown flashes of athleticism at times, but I think far too tight. They have lapses, they have stretches, which is very un-Terrapin-like for this for Maryland, for John Tillman coach teams. But if Maryland can win this game, it'll be the 8th championship weekend appearance in 9 years. That's pretty impressive.
That's an incredible number. So the Terps are definitely experienced, and they're no strangers to the spotlight, and they will be ready to play. And that should be this might be my favorite game of the weekend, next to the Loyola.
Coming out of the gate strong. Coming out of the gate strong, Dan.
A big weekend on Long Island with the PGA Championship over at Bethpage, and these two games on Saturday. What a weekend for a sports fan.
How about that?
Second game of the day.
Gambling is illegal at Bushwood. I will remind you of that.
And I never slice. Second game from Hofstra, Schuert Stadium, number 7 seed Notre Dame. Winners over Johns Hopkins will take on number 2 seed Duke, who slipped by Richmond last week. This game will be at 2:30 following the Maryland-Virginia game.
Wow. And last meeting, a couple weeks ago in the ACC semifinals, when Notre Dame won 12-10. Get this, all right, in my research. This will be the 20th time Duke and Notre Dame have met on the lacrosse field since 2010.
Okay.
20 times this decade these guys have met since 2010. And they've played twice every season since 2012, but this will be the first time Notre Dame and Duke will have played 3 times in a season. So positives, hey, we know each other. Drawbacks, if there's new wrinkles that we're not prepared for. And I think the biggest wrinkle that Notre Dame possesses is Ryder Garnsey, who came back last week against Johns Hopkins, scored a couple of goals. Albeit I thought the game was well in hand for the Irish when Garnsey came on the field and contributed, but there was no mistake in how happy his teammates were to have him back and how excited they were for him to find the back of the cage. It was an energy and an exuberance that really elevated, I thought, Notre Dame and their, you know, it really galvanized them. And it's going to be interesting to see how that works out moving forward for the Irish. And this is a player that's familiar to Duke, but he hasn't played with Notre Dame and their offense this year. And this is a year where Notre Dame's offense is better than their defense. That rarely, if ever, happens in South Bend. But the defense is not a typical Notre Dame defense. They're still very, very good. But the offense is really, really strong. It's going to be interesting to see how Garnsey fits into the game plan against the Blue Devils.
And who do you think are the X factors in this game, besides Garney Notre Dame?
Yeah, well, Garnsey's the X factor for Notre Dame, no question. I think their goaltender, Matt Schmidt, who had 18 saves in the semifinal against Duke, has got, you know, and that's going to be a theme. You know, we're talking about goaltending here. You know, you got to have decent goaltending when you get to this stage of the tournament. Turner Upgren for Duke, I think, is an X factor for the Blue Devils. It's opposites this year. Notre Dame's strength is their offense. Duke's strength is their defense.
Yeah.
With Van Rapphorst, with JT Giles Harris, with Pendergrast, he's having a terrific season. Turner Upgren, you know, I think the Duke defense are going to put Notre Dame in spots to shoot savable shots, and I think Upgren's going to need to come up with those saves. I anticipate a pretty physical game. I mean, this is the rubber match with the highest stakes possible going to championship weekend to date between these two teams. So should be a knockdown, drag 'em out affair between the Irish and the Blue Devils.
Earlier this week, I had a chance to sit down to talk to Notre Dame junior midfielder, All-American Brian Costabile, and I asked him about Ryder Garnsey and facing Duke for a third time. And here's what Brian had to say. We're joined by the ACC Offensive Player of the Year and an IL first-team All-American, Notre Dame's junior midfielder, Brian Costabile. Brian, welcome into the D-Fly and Dixie podcast.
Hey, how's it going? Good. Thanks for having me.
Hey, this past weekend, you beat my Johns Hopkins Blue Jays in the first round of the NCAA tournament. Congratulations on that. And that had to be a great feeling to get that first tournament win under your belt this year.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much, by the way. And, yeah, it was awesome. I mean, we losing to Denver in the first round last year, we had that bitter taste in our mouth, and we really wanted to come out swinging in that first round. So it was good to finally do that and kind of take care of business.
Yeah, you mentioned the fast start you had. It took a 10-2 lead at halftime, and as a Hopkins fan, I thought the game was over. What was the keys to your fast start?
Honestly, it was just kind of moving the ball and just playing unselfishly. So one of the biggest things we said was we just wanted to get the ball moving and kind of get it in other people's hands and just make sure that, you know, no one's holding it for too long and no one's trying to do too much. And we know that our offense is the best when we do that. So we were trying to just, you know, move it as fast as we could and then get it to the backside where, you know, some good opportunities could have. And we have players like Mo Meyer and Ryder and Brendan Gleason and all them that were able to, like, you know, make really good dodges, really good plays and everything like that. And we got people that are excel in on those type of dodges. So kind of just coming out with hot energy and trying to get on them early. So kind of it would have been a struggle for them to come back, was definitely a key for us.
One of the big things surrounding the game was the return of Ryder Garza, who you mentioned. He played for the first time all season. He had 3 goals, 1 assist. What does he add to the Irish?
Honestly, he adds a tremendous amount. I mean, even you can tell just even Ryder just being on the field, Hopkins had to account for them. And it's just a new piece of the puzzle. I mean, our attack's been doing great this entire year, but then Ryder comes back and, you know, they have to draw some attention to him. It opens up looks for everything else. And even when he doesn't have the ball, he moves off ball really well, and he does everything just as well out of his stick as he does in. So just kind of having to, like I said, account for him and make sure that he's just not roaming free opens up everything else for everyone else on the field at all points. And I think it definitely showed in that game that not only that he had those points, but everyone else was able to have a lot more points as well.
Yeah, another player that really had a breakout performance, and you mentioned him, was Morrison Meyer. Between Garnsey and Meyer, it seems like a huge spark, that duo, to the offense, and it's really changed things. Do you think you can keep that going as you move forward?
Absolutely. You know, we always want to look one game at a time, so we're definitely just preparing for Duke and trying to do everything we can there. But I've always known that Mo had that in him. We always see it in practice. He's the fastest kid we have. He's so good. He's very ambidextrous, and he would always have those spurts in practice, and we were just waiting for him to have that breakout game, and he picked the right time to do it. So none of us were surprised, but I know that he was extremely happy that he picked that game to kind of, you know, show what he had, get more comfortable.
Sure. Hey, so this week you face Duke for the third time this season. Just to recap for the listeners, lost a regular season game 14-8 in Durham, but you got revenge with a 12-10 win in the ACC semifinals. As the Irish prepare for round three, unusual to face a team 3 times in the same season, what do you need to do to get a victory and advance to championship weekend?
Honestly, I think the thing that we have to do first and foremost is just come out with a lot of energy. I mean, we know that Duke is going to be hungry. They lost to us in the ACC semifinals, and they're going to come out and want revenge from not only that, but just clearly moving forward because it's win or go home. So we need to make sure that we come out and exceed their energy just right out the gates. And then just playing smart lacrosse, you know, not trying to do too much. Duke has a great defense. They got really good offensive people too. So just being smart and doing everything that we know that we can do on defense and offense and in between. I know that Charlie will take care of business, but just doing it, like I said, doing everything we can, being smart, being poised, and just coming out hot in order to try and get that good start and then keep it rolling through the rest of the game. Because I know we've kind of sometimes at times struggled to get to keep a consistent 4 quarters, but I think that's just the biggest thing for us.
Hey, on a personal level, you have been piling up some really cool accolades this season. As I mentioned before, you were first team inside lacrosse All-American, the ACC Offensive Player of the Year, and you joined some elite company at Notre Dame in John Sexton and Matt Landis as being named as a Player of the Year, offensive, defensive, in the ACC. What's it mean to you to be mentioned with guys like Sexton and Landis? And next question would be, how's it feel to be the first Irish offensive player to earn that kind of Player of the Year recognition?
Honestly, it's almost surreal. You know, I try in season to not really focus on a lot of those like accolades and everything, because I really sure. Enjoy, I mean, everyone always says they really want to, like, you know, be the best that they can and everything they do, but our ultimate goal is to win the championship. But it's just looking at that, and it's definitely surreal, because I know that like when I was growing up and watching Landis play, he was always an amazing player, and then coming and playing with Sexton every day, where he would just take my stick and just throw it across the field and stuff like that, was always like an incredible thing. And I was like, wow, this kid's really, really good. So to kind of be looked at as that is definitely a cool feeling. And I mean, it's definitely great that, you know, my hard work is being recognized, but it was very unexpected, and I was happy that I got it, but I definitely was a little surprised about it, honestly. But it means a lot to be the first offensive guy to do that. I mean, I definitely love that, but like I said, I know, moving forward, our ultimate goal is to kind of win that national championship. And then at the end of the season, you know, you can step back and be like, okay, like, I accomplished this season. Maybe next year I want to get to this X, Y, and Z. But, you know, all that stuff is all great, but if you can't win a national championship, it's definitely not as sweet.
Sure. So you mentioned the goal for the Irish is always to win the national championship, and you guys have been right there several times over the last decade. The Irish have had mostly an up-and-down season this year. Your longest winning streak is 2 games. So what do you think you need to do to put together that 4-game winning streak needed to win it all this time?
I think the main thing that we have to do is just kind of taking one play at a time. You know, if we start looking forward and saying we need to win this game, then the next game, then the next game, we kind of just start to lose focus. Mm-hmm. And I think that the most important thing is just kind of looking at Duke and saying, okay, we need to get this ground ball. We need to make this play. We need to, like, and then it continues to pile up moment after moment. And then it turns into a good quarter, which turns into a good half, which turns into a good game overall. And I mean, if we do everything that we know how to do and the best that we can, I think that we can beat any team in the country. So I know that just doing those little things and trying to take it one step at a time will kind of help us in the end put together those games that we really want. But it all comes down to like the little things and kind of just making the simple plays.
Sure. Okay, Brian, I have some rapid fire questions for you to wrap this up. You ready?
Yep.
Okay, you grew up outside of Baltimore in Sykesville, Maryland. What players did you emulate as a kid?
I loved watching. Honestly, I had 3 older brothers, and my brother Chris was always someone that I really looked up to because he played college across at Dartmouth, and I always really wanted to try and be like him. But from a more professional standpoint, I liked how Paul Rabo played, and kind of it was a downhill Dodger, and I always thought of myself more as like a big shooter and a big Dodger. So I always try and maybe emulate kind of him or Kyle Harrison type players.
What's your favorite road trip to take in the ACC and why?
I really like going to Virginia. We always stay at a very nice hotel, and it's close to my family, so I know a lot of my family comes to that and everything. It's great seeing them. And we have some, besides this year, we had some good memories there too. So I definitely loved going there.
Who has the best crab cakes or steamed crabs in Maryland?
Personally, I think Salerno's has some of the best steamed crabs. That's a little place in Sykesville. Me and my family go there all the time and get a bushel of crabs and just kind of eat them in our house. And I mean, they're incredible and have a good price.
Man, I haven't heard of Salerno's. I'm going to have to check that out on your recommendation. All right.
Oh, yeah.
Brian, you were a very good high school quarterback at Mount St. Joe's. Who's your favorite Notre Dame football player ever?
I think I'd have to go maybe Joe Montana. I mean, that's kind of a basic one, but he was a quarterback. I was a quarterback. He's an incredible player. And I know growing up, my dad would always watch like the best of these quarterbacks because he played quarterback at Fordham as well. So I would always watch that with him. And I always thought that was really cool that he went to Notre Dame, especially when I got here. So I think I definitely would have to say him.
You don't want to mention one of your teammates' dads who also was a great Notre Dame quarterback?
Oh, Mr. Meyer. I love Mr. Meyer as well. I love watching him. I remember me and my brother grew up with him. And it's funny because my brother the other day actually was looking through some of his old football cards, and he actually found a Rick Meyer Notre Dame football card. And he sent me a picture and was like, dude, this is your teammate's brother or your teammate's dad. I was like, yeah, I know. It's like kind of cool. He was an awesome player too, and I really enjoyed watching him as well. It's really cool because like whenever I hang out with him, I'm like, damn, like this guy was big time, you know, like kind of stuff like that. So it's really cool. Oh, yeah.
All right. This year, for the first time, there'll be 2 pro outdoor lacrosse leagues. So MLL or PLL for you?
I think I would have to go with PLL, because a bunch of the kids that I played with, like Surge and, Sexton and Glebo now are all playing in that league. And it's kind of, you know, I kind of love watching them as well. And I know that Landis and Kavanaugh have all reached out to me at different points and have been really nice, but like, and trying to help me with my game and everything like that. So it's kind of fun watching all them and kind of rooting for them as well. And especially because I've played with a few and on other teams as well of those guys.
All right. Last question. What is the best non-lacrosse related thing about Notre Dame?
Honestly, I think one of the best things about Notre Dame is its alumni network. And I think that it's just so special that anywhere you go, you know, you just make connections instantly because you went to Notre Dame and you played lacrosse. We go to a bunch of dinners and everything like that. And these guys, you wouldn't know it, but you feel like you knew them for 10 years. You know, they have stories about like everything that you went through. There's an instant connection there. You know, I've talked to a bunch of people that work in New York. And then, like I said, like even people that I've never played with, like Kavanaugh, Landis, always reach out and talk to you and try and, you know, just like instill that network in you. And it's really special that people, they always talk about it when you didn't go here, but when you go here now, people really try and make an effort to help you out with the job search and lacrosse and everything like that. So I think that's definitely something that's very unique about Notre Dame.
Well, Brian, thanks for joining us on the D-Fly and Dixie podcast, and best of luck to you and your Irish teammates against Duke on Saturday in the NCAA quarterfinals.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
All right, Dixie, moving on to Sunday's games. These games will be played at Pratt and Whitney Stadium at Rentschler Field in East Hartford, Connecticut. A new venue for NCAA championship play, and will be the site for the quarterfinals this year and next, I believe. And then in 2021, Rentschler Field will be the host site for the championship weekend.
Break it in with a heck of a matchup on Sunday, Loyola Penn State. Right off the bat, Ament Spencer. Great note from Ryan Eigenbrode in the SID for Loyola. This will be the 53rd meeting all time between Loyola and Penn State. Get this, behind Hopkins and Towson, this is the third most ever played opponent in Loyola lacrosse history. You believe
that? Surprises me. That surprises me.
It does. It does. I would have thought it was maybe, I'm trying to think of the conference alignments. You know, Loyola's been in a number of conference alignments throughout the years, but I would have thought it would have been maybe a Navy,
or a Navy.
Lehigh, something along those lines. Even Maryland. I mean, Loyola used to play Maryland. Actually, they've never played Maryland very regularly, so that wouldn't be the case. Maybe a UMBC.
I mean, maybe Mount St. Mary's, you know? or some other team from Maryland.
Georgetown's sure. A team that they've had a series with, but it's Penn State. It's Penn State. But this will be the first time that these two teams have met since 2015 when Loyola won 8-6. Again, obviously it's about Ament and Spencer. A lot of people feel like whoever wins this game is going to win the Tewaratine. I say not so fast, because T.D. Erlin is still playing, and if the Bulldogs can get the championship weekend and hoist a trophy on Memorial Day, could we have our first ever face-off specialist win the TUI? But, I think the supporting cast in this game obviously are going to be huge. Mac O'Keefe is the main target for Ament. You've got Kevin Lindley, who's been a little quiet lately, actually, is the main target for Pat Spencer. But you got to be impressed with Aiden Olmstead and his production over the last couple of, over the last month of the season, coming back from injury. I thought Olmstead has been terrific. Big question marks for me defensively for both teams. Can Loyola give enough support to Jacob Stover? This is not a team you want to trifle with in Penn State and leave it on the shoulders of Stover to win the game for you. He may eventually make that save or two at the end of the contest. That can be the difference, but you can't expect him to make 25 saves against Penn State, which is the pressure that the D-Lions will put on the Greyhounds. Big question for Penn State, who's going to guard Spencer? Will it be Big Ten Defensive Player of the Year, Chris Sabia, or will it be Nick Cardio? Cardio actually ended up taking Cole Williams in the Big Ten Championship early in that game. They switched the matchup when Joey Epstein started going crazy, and they put Sabia on Epstein. Or maybe I have to go back and look at the tape, but I know they switched that matchup. And Cardio is a junkyard dog. He's mean and nasty. Will he match up? So those are the questions that I have, defensively. And then when you look at the faceoff dot, you've got Gerard Arcari, and Jake Glatz has really come on. He was huge in the Big Ten championship game. He got a number of reps against UMBC, even scored a goal. How will that two-headed monster affect Bailey Salvio, who has been terrific at faceoffs for Loyola, but he's been a one-man band all season long for the Greyhounds? What will his durability be like up in Connecticut on Sunday?
Well, there's certainly a lot of star power, as you mentioned, in Spencer and Amon, but who do you think are the X factors?
For Loyola, I picked P.J. Brown because he's a guy who had two goals last weekend against Syracuse. He's part of a midfield core. You've got Duffy. You've got McGovern, who can hybrid, but he's playing more midfield now. Chase Scanlon is the headliner, but he's been – him and Spencer tend to have the balls die in their stick when things don't go well. And when I say things don't go well, the Army game was a prime example. I think Loyola's got to keep it hot. P.J. Brown's a guy that's going to have to play well. Tommy Wright, the long stick midfielder for Penn State, is the next factor for me. Everybody knows about Ament missing last season. Well, so did Tommy Wright with an injury. And I think as much as Ament has meant to the offensive side of the ball with his comeback, Tommy Wright has been that big boost in the arm from an energy standpoint, from a toughness standpoint. Tommy Wright's return has bolstered Penn State immensely. And he's going to be matched up on probably Chase Scanlon. Him and Mike Aronow will probably take Scanlon throughout this ball game. So those are my X factors for each team.
Moving on, the fourth and final game of the weekend following the Loyola-Penn State game, number 5 seed Yale, defending champs, play their Ivy League nemesis this season, the number 4 seed of Penn Quakers, at 2:30 in a third matchup of these two teams this season.
And as we talked about, Dan, unfortunate that these two ball clubs are meeting up in the quarterfinals. Fans win, but Yale and Penn lacrosse teams are... One of them is going to go home after this game, and both, I think, are capable of making it to championship weekend. Last time these guys played, May 5th, the Ivy League championship game, Penn won 12-11. So whereas Notre Dame and Duke, it's a rubber match. Series is 1-1. This is 2-2-2-0 in favor of the Quakers. They won triple overtime, then they won a one-goal game back in May. So Penn is looking to advance to the national semifinals for the first time since 1988. Remember what happened in 1988?
Is that the Air Gate?
Penn, Air Gate. Air Gate, that was Tony Seaman. And Chris Flynn was his best player in the midfield for the Quakers. And Air Gate twice. And Paul Gate scored a goal against John Canaris, a gentleman I've had the opportunity to work with at Merck for a couple of years. Canaris was the goalie, tremendous goalie for Penn. Had a great game that day, actually. And he's a Lynbrook guy, wrestler, with Quint Kesnick back in the day. He gave up the game winner, or I shouldn't say he gave up. Paul Gate scored the game winner with short time in that game up at the Carrier Dome. So Penn's looking to get back for the first time in over 30 years, whereas Yale, as you mentioned, defending national champions. This is a Bulldog team that's playing some good lacrosse right now, and they're giving up a lot of goals, though, but they can score a lot, and they get a lot of possessions with T.D. Erlin.
Yeah, that face-off matchup is going to be key in this game. Between Erlin and Penn faceoff man Kyle Gallagher, who do you think are the X factors in this game for each team?
Well, that's a great point you bring up. Kyle Gallagher being able to go 50-50 against T.D. Erlin is an accomplishment, and that's a win in most people's books. So Gallagher Erlin is a great faceoff matchup we're looking at. How about the goaltenders Reed Junkin and Jack Starr, both playing good lacrosse? Were 50% last week in each of their team's wins, but at this stage of the season, you just want to be able to make saves at the right time. But X factors, I love Joey Sessa for Yale, all 5'5", 5'6" of them, just a spark plug and a guy who's tough and scores really key goals. And for Penn, I like long stick midfielder B.J. Farrar, the freshman. He's a catalyst for their transition, and he's got the long pole is great and tight, so skilled. Tremendous athlete with great speed. He's a football player. Really what impressed me about Farrar is his ability to operate that long stick in tight quarters. And he had a nice assist last week against Army. I think it was to Simon Mathias up at the top of the offense. Mathias hammered one home, but it was like a 3-yard pass. It was beautiful from B.J. Farrar.
The game we were just talking about, the Yale-Penn game, it's their third meeting. And that face-off matchup is going to be huge. I had a chance to sit down with Yale head coach Andy Shea earlier this week, and we talked about those two things. Also, the tournament coming to East Hartford, close game for the Yale Bulldogs and Connecticut fans of lacrosse. And here's that conversation with him. We're joined by Yale head coach Andy Shea. Coach Shea, welcome into the D-Fly and Dixie podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Coach, first of all, congratulations on another NCAA quarterfinal appearance. Winning an NCAA game is an accomplishment, and every single one of them should be cherished. How would you compare this year's squad to last year's championship team?
Well, I appreciate you saying that about winning an NCAA game. I think people sometimes take that for granted. It's just not an easy thing to do. But with respect to last year, to be honest, man, we're trying to stop comparing this year to last year, to be honest with you. At the same time, the stark similarities between how our season has gone it's not difficult to see, the opening loss and the midseason loss and the loss in the Ivy, in the Ivy finals. So hopefully the similarities continue, but at this point, it's a very different group, in a different team, a different year, and, different opponents. So, we're just trying to get better, much like last year's team. And at this point, I don't know if I quite remember, I keep all of our practice plans, but I don't quite remember the state of how we were going into the Loyola game. So it's been a whirlwind year.
I can only imagine. So let's start by talking about your first round opponent. You beat Georgetown 19-16 last week. You raced out to a 7-0 lead. It was 9-3 after one period. Then you withstood a barrage from the Hoyas to advance to the next round. T.D. Erlin put up a historic performance at the faceoff. And first of all, how do you put into words or categorize a performance like T.D. put in, winning 31 faceoffs, which is an NCAA tourney record, an NCAA record, 29 ground balls? How do you put into words that kind of performance?
One way to describe it, and it's not the first time that this has happened, is that he breaks NCAA records when people aren't even aware, and it's the second time he's done it. Against Harvard, I didn't know that he broke the record, and I had said, let's, give him a rest. And thankfully, one of my assistants, Ed Williams, knew that he was on the verge of the record. He didn't argue when we pulled him because he knew he already had it. So with the ground ball one, we didn't know about that record until, a couple days afterwards. So he's just an exceptional talent. I mean, I suppose now we have to be, on the ready in these moments, have the book available to flip through it to make sure that something isn't happening. Save a couple game balls for the kid.
All right. Second, what were your general thoughts on the game?
Well, I thought it was a great game. I felt like we came out really hot and we were playing really fast, and we were talking about on the sideline, like, we're probably going a little too fast here. And we knew that they would come back. We didn't know the degree to which they would come back. We felt like when we got it to 9-1, Kevin Warren, I've known him for, feels like forever. I know his kids play really hard, and every team he's had is not going to quit. So, when they got it to 12-6, we were trying to slow down a little bit, to keep the pace a little bit slower after 9-1, and it probably proved to be the wrong decision. We probably should have, kept going. We slowed down a smidge and then it was 12-6. And then in the second half, they inched back a little further in the third. And I give my guys a lot of credit for stretching that lead again at the start of the fourth. And, they just kept coming at us. So just one of those games where it feels like there's a couple offenses have hot hands, and I think we outlast them. So I think they're an excellent team, and they should be very proud of the season that they had.
Sure. So the old motto is survive and advance. When you look at the stats, you dominated a possession in the game, scored 19 goals, and your goalie made 16 saves. That would generally spell a complete blowout, but it really wasn't the case. What lessons did you take away from that, and what do you think you need to clean up defensively as you move forward?
Well, I think that there isn't a defenseman on our team that feels great about their cover performance the other day. You know, and that's both days are gonna happen. You know, I think that those are, you know, some incredible attackmen that put up ridiculous performances, but there's a little bit of when you're down one and it's do or die and you can dodge reckless to the cage however you want. And in a lot of ways, that's to their advantage. You know what I mean? So, and especially if they're hitting shots. You know, he had 18 shots. So it's an incredibly heroic performance by him. But I don't think our guys played that well on the ball. Played a little bit on their heels, and then, you know, when they start getting closer, I think that they started to play a little bit more on their heels. So it was just a bit of a weird game. I've said it a few times. I said it to Kevin after the game, if it's 6-5 in the second, you know, does this final score look anything like this?
Yeah.
And I don't know if it does. You know, I think we probably play a little bit better defensively and they probably do too. So, you know, I think it just, when it opened up at 9-1, I think both teams just kind of started playing a little faster. I don't know.
Right.
But I think for a fan's perspective, it must have been fun to watch.
It absolutely was. It definitely was. Hey, on the offensive side, Jackson Morrill's been awesome this season. He's the QB of your offense. He's top 10 nationally in points per game and assists. After graduating an all-timer like Ben Reeves, what's Jackson Morrill meant to your team this year?
Well, I mean, you know, I would agree with you. He's awesome. Eddie's a phenomenal kid, and, you know, he does everything we ask him to do, and then some. And he has shouldered a great deal of the load, you know, as we've shuffled our attack a little bit. But he's never complained. He comes to practice every day, hurt or otherwise, and guts it out, you know. And then he has a quiet, you know, 5 points or 8 points or whatever. And I'll say that half jokingly. He's just one of those guys who can get through a game and have a ton of points, and, you know, he just does so much for our offense. He could be a goal scorer. He can be a feeder, distributor. He carries for us. He's a stabilizing force for the offensive guys. He's like a coach on the field. I think he is one of the top attackmen in the country, and I think he's overshadowed a little bit in our league. And I'm not sure that's fair at this point. I mean, he's been the field general for our team, and, you know, I was talking to Mike Murphy and Penn about it. I think Mathias and Moore are the two best attackmen in that league. And, you know, he agrees. It's just, right. they do so much for both of our teams.
Hey, let's look forward to this weekend. The quarterfinals will be played at Pratt and Whitney Stadium at Rentschler Field. But it's just about 45 minutes up the road from Yale and East Hartford. It's a new NCAA location for a quarterfinal, and that site will serve as the location of championship weekend beginning in 2021. Obviously, this is great for Yale and Bulldogs fans, but can you put into perspective what this means for lacrosse and Connecticut and the region as a whole?
I mean, I think it's just, I haven't had a chance to, you know, really think too much about it. You know, as you're hoping to be in not only the quarterfinals, but in this side of the bracket, because you want to play there. You know, I think that it's going to be huge. It's huge for New England. I think that on the heels of, you know, Foxborough having great attendance last year, I think this is a big deal. And I think that you look at the teams that are in this, it's going to be exciting for people to see quarterfinal lacrosse there. It's not a, like you said, it's not a traditional site. It's a big stadium. I've never even actually been there. I've just seen it, you know, driving by it, and I've seen it in pictures. But I think it's New England and Connecticut's chance to show lacrosse world that we can support it. And I'm excited. I'm hoping there's a ton of people there, and, you know, we're going to have great weather. The field conditions look phenomenal right now. So
that's great.
It'll be exciting to see, you know, how well received it is. I think they've sold a ton of tickets so far. I'm not sure what the total gate's going to be, but I'm hoping it's big.
Yeah, no doubt. We all hope for great success this weekend and moving forward. Hey, one critique of the NCAA selection committee that a lot of people had was that you and Penn were on a course to meet in the quarterfinals, and here we are. And this will be round three with the Penn Quakers, which doesn't happen a lot, right, especially when conference rivals meeting so early. Like some people said, oh, if it happened in the Final Four, that'd be one thing. But for you to advance from the first round and meet in the quarters, maybe that's not fair to you guys. But here we are. Yeah. Yale's never faced an opponent three times in the same season before. And each, you know, if we're looking at this year, you lost by the narrowest of margins, one in three overtimes, and another 12-11 in the Ivy League championship game, which was one of the best games of the whole college season. What's your team's mindset as you get ready to face a conference rival for the third time in the same season?
Well, you know, I think our guys are just, you know, excited to be playing at this time of year, you know, and that can't be lost on anybody as far as I'm concerned. Having been in the quarterfinals a few times, you know, it's a big deal. And the Final Four is a big deal as well, but I think it's just it's a huge accomplishment for both teams to be in this situation. The fact that we're playing Penn, you know, it is what it is. I don't think the committee did the job they could do, you know, and that's the way the seeding worked out, and kind of is what it is. It doesn't really matter to me. You know, it does make prep a little different. I'm sure Mike Murphy feels the same way. It's like, we got to write the Penn scouting report one more time. Yeah. It's like, really, you know what I mean? We could coach each other's teams. We know him so well. So, that part of it's a little bit different. But other than that, you know, we're just the last team, eight teams playing. So we're excited to get out there and play again one more week.
So what do the Bulldogs need to do differently this week to get a victory and move on to the championship weekend?
Well, I mean, for us, it's always about fundamentals and being as fundamental as we possibly can. And, you know, we can't get caught up in the ebbs and flows of the game. We just got to worry about the next play. And, you know, we as a group and as a team have tried to get better at that over the course of the season. And I think our guys would agree that we haven't quite perfected that. And it, you know, it's something that not every team gets to do. but for us, if we can be process oriented and, you know, play a smart fundamental game, I think that gives us the best chance to be successful. They're going to be, you know, they're the Ivy League champs. They're one of the best teams in the country, and they're seated above us for a reason. And we know that it's going to be a huge challenge.
One area I know a lot of people focus on this week is the face-off position and a battle between T.D. Erlen and Kyle Gallagher. T.D. has been so sensational over his career and this year that when he goes head-to-head with someone and the other person's about 50-50, it seems like he's not having a good game. So right, in their two matchups, they're basically 50-50 for the season. What do you think will be the keys this week as this matchup is concerned?
TD's a competitor, and he's looking forward to this game. I think for Yale, I think it's here's the crazy part. When he's not 80%, we're a little confused. You know, it's unfair to him. You know
it
what
is
I mean?
Unfair. And it's a high standard.
You know what I mean? I think that, and, you know, I've told him many times, like, it's not, you know, we need to use him as a weapon, not a crutch. And to that point where we were using him as a crutch. So I think that, you know, our wing play has got to be way better than it has been. You know, and I think TD is going to be, you know, he's, like I said, he's a competitor and he's looking forward to, you know, seeing what can happen this time around. So it's a situation where we know that their guy is incredible. We know that. So, he's going to have to once again rely on his fundamentals, and we got to be great off the wing. And, you know, if he does really well, then great. But that's a part of the game. You know, it's not the whole game for us. So it just so happens when he's so dominant that it ends up being a larger part of the game than we want it to be. So I think that, you know, he understands that we got plenty of other guys that are going to be able to help out on the wing and, you know, go from there. And once again, we got to we got to be efficient on offense and efficient on defense no matter what happens to the X.
Yeah, last question about the Quakers. They're clicking on all cylinders offensively, led by sensational freshman Sam Hanley, who was the Rookie of the Year in the Ivy League and in our IL Media All-America team. He was a first-team midfielder. How do you slow down that Penn offense?
You don't. You know, you don't. They have ridiculous talent in all areas, and you know, you gotta do your best to cover them, you know, in space. And those guys are big, and they're fast, physical, and strong. So, you know, I think for us, it was the last two times we played them, it was punch for punch. We got to be a little smarter this time around, and like I said, we got to be more efficient on both sides of the ball. Defensively, I'm not sure anyone has shut them down at this point. So, you know, I think that we can, once again, just be a little smarter on the defense side of the ball. Hopefully we can slow them down a little bit.
All right, Coach, last question for you. The Bulldogs have been the team of the decade in the Ivy League, winning 7 Ivy League titles, a national championship, with more to play this season. Since you've been at Yale, you've more or less completely changed the perception of the Yale program. So in your own words, what is this new standard for Yale lacrosse?
You know, I think our standard, I would like to think that our standard has more to do with how we come to work every day than with the wins and losses. And I think that this year has proven very difficult to be a team that is like other Yale lacrosse teams, because people expect us to be the number one team in the country, or, you know, repeat the national championship, repeat the Final Four. I mean, it was hard enough to repeat to get back to the quarterfinals. So keeping my guys focused on coming to work every day and being, you know, that version of the Yale lacrosse team that, you know, has put us in this position, has been very difficult. But I think the guys are starting to get it. I certainly appreciate the compliments, but, you know, the Yale lacrosse kind of ethos is just showing up and working every day and trying to get better, not trying to win games as much as it is trying to win practices.
Well, Coach, I can't wait to watch you play Penn this weekend. Coach Shea, thanks for joining us, and best of luck to you in the quarterfinals.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
So, again, these are teams that are just fantastic, and it's a shame that they're meeting in the quarterfinals, but fans win. And that brings me – so there's something I wanted to bring up with you.
Mm-hmm.
In our research for the UMC-Penn State game last week, okay, we have had, 2010 Duke, 2012 Loyola, 2015 Denver, 2018 Yale.
Yes.
We've had 4 first-time national champions.
In this decade. After 25 years with, 6 schools winning it? Hopkins, Virginia, Princeton, Syracuse, and North Carolina, I think, were the only schools that won.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right around that name. Well, you said Hopkins, Syracuse, Cornell, Maryland,
North Carolina, and Virginia,
fifth?
Princeton.
North Carolina, Virginia. Yeah, they're 6. Yeah, you're right. And Princeton. But I guess Princeton doesn't count as 25 years, because that's coming up. Well, that's Princeton's first was 27 years ago, 92, right?
Yeah, but I'm saying prior to the decade, there were this decade. There were a handful of schools that had a hold on Final Four weekend for the most part, and definitely national championships. And we've seen that really expand over those last decade.
Right, exactly. So what I had put together, and what we ran a semblance of it, and had my play-by-play man, John Brook, and I had a discussion. So there's common themes for all those teams. One is you have a dynamic scoring duo, guys that can put the ball in the back of the cage for you.
Okay.
Next, you have a player in the middle of the field that can dominate and can make things happen. And then you have a goaltender who all those teams had good goalies, but none of them were All-Americans when they won the national championship. So let's look at Duke. Duke 2010, Crotty and Quinzani were the dynamic duo. C.J. Costabile was the guy in the middle. And then Dan Wigreiser. Remember that name, Dan Wigreiser?
Wow.
He was a maligned. He wasn't – not only was he not like an All-American, he was maligned. And Duke still won a national championship with him in Cage. 2012, Loyola. Dynamic duo, Eric Lusby and Mike Sawyer. And you could throw Justin Ward in there as well. Guys in the middle of the field, Scott Ratliff, Josh Hawkins. Their goaltender was Jack Runkle. Big body, very good goalie, but not an All-American. 2015, Denver. Dynamic duo, Connor Canizzaro, Wesley Berg. Face-off man in the middle, Trevor Baptiste. And their goalie was Ryan LaPlante. Good goalie, but not legendary. Last year, Yale. Dynamic duo, Ben Reeves, Matt Gaudette, who's back this year. Man in the middle. You can take Connor Mackey at the faceoff, but I choose Tyler Werner, the sensational long stick, short stick defensive middie. And then Jack Starr, who's back in Cage this year for Yale. Not an All-American. You look at Penn State this year, what do they have? They've got Grant Ament and Mac O'Keefe scoring goals in bunches. You got Gerard Arcieri in the middle of the field. Probably, what, second or third best faceoff man in the country behind Erlin?
He'll be an All-American.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to be an All-American this year. And then you've got Colby Canese, who I think he's going to be an All-American this year. I think he might be able to grab honorable mention, especially if he has a good stretch run. But he hasn't been great lately. He was shaky early in the game against UMBC, and he made a huge save at the end of regulation against Johns Hopkins, and he made 13 saves in that game. But he still gave up 17. So those parallels, is, I guess what I'm getting at, is Penn State has a lot of those parallels to be a first-time national champion that those other four ball clubs did.
Yeah, they sure do. No doubt.
I thought I was going to knock your socks off, but I guess not.
No,
okay. We'll move on.
I think there's some other teams who would – I think you could say the same thing about Penn. Penn's got those kind of duos, too, in scoring. They have
Simon Mathias, Sam Hanley, and then Kyle
Adam
Gallagher
Goldman
in the middle, and Reed Junkin.
Yep.
Reed Junkin. Yeah, I agree. They could be a first-time national champion. I think that's a great point you bring up. And that, look, I just said I think Virginia could get to the national championship and possibly win it. Penn as well. I mean, Penn, if they can beat Yale, they'll play the winner of Loyola, Penn State. And that Penn-Penn State game earlier this season, that was a one-goal game, right?
Mm-hmm. It was.
Yeah, in favor of the Nittany Lions. So, yeah, Penn's a... That's a great pool. That's a good point that you make. But I think if you surveyed 10 people, what would you say? Seven out of ten, 8 out of 10 are saying they think Penn State's going to win it all.
Yeah,
is
I think
accurate?
Penn State's a favorite. I mean, they're number one seed, 15-1, haven't lost a game since or much earlier this year. And I think most people would say that they're the favorite going into the quarterfinals still. So we'll see what happens. It's going to be a very exciting weekend, no doubt. You just got me really fired up. And if you like what you heard, please do us a favor. Smash that subscribe button, leave a rating, and share this podcast with a friend. It's easy to do. Just share. Everybody likes sharing. You can hit us up on Twitter, @DixonLacrosse, and @D_FLY, @DFly. Or you can email me at dflynn@insidelacrosse.com. Always respond to the emails. Love hearing from you. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcast here at Inside Lacrosse. We drop a new one every day during the season. Have a great week and enjoy the games.